In the early fall of 1923, Larkin became the hottest boomtown in Texas, with oil men from all parts of America streaming in to try their luck at the far perimeters of the undefined field. To a stranger, the Larkin field did not look like a typical oil site, because as soon as a well was dug, the towering pyramidal structure that meant oil to the layman was quickly moved to some other location for more drilling. The actual pumping of oil from deep below the surface was turned over to an unromantic donkey engine, a small, low-slung affair which could barely be seen from a distance. The donkey, powered by gasoline, worked its relatively short arm up and down incessantly. And from it poured the oil which was turning Larkin gamblers into millionaires. Companies, big and little, rushed in their landmen to acquire leases. And wherever they turned, they found themselves confronted by Floyd Rusk, who either owned the land, controlled the leases, or had power of attorney for handling the leases owned by his partner, Dewey Kimbrough. It was now that Rusk demonstrated both his devious managerial skill and his untamed voraciousness, for he saw quickly that he and Kimbrough controlled far more land than they could ever drill. And if they didn't act quickly, they would lose certain of their short-term leases outright, and then watch as other men's wells sucked out the oil from under their long-term ones. As if he had been in the business for generations, Rusk dealt out his leases to the major companies, scattering them so they would do his own holdings the most good, and using the money he obtained from them for the drilling of his own additional wells. "A man could make a good living," he told Kimbrough, "just buying and selling leases and never drilling an inch into the ground. Let some other dumb bastard do the hard work." Now, a fundamental difference between the two partners surfaced. Kimbrough loved oil itself, the endless search, even the heartbreaking failures, the lucky hit, the bringing of oil to the surface, while Rusk's interest blossomed only when the bubbling oil came into his actual possession. He reveled in the tricky deals, the exploitation, the pyramiding of the wealth that oil provided. If left alone, Kimbrough would have ranged over all of Texas, identifying new fields, bringing them to fruition, and then turning them over to the managerial care of Floyd Rusk. His only interest in the money which his wells produced was that it enabled him to search for others. However, under Rusk's canny leadership, Kimbrough was kept close to the Larkin field, which the partners manipulated as if it were some giant poker game, and more than one major company entered into its files a recommendation that Floyd Rusk be either shot or placed on the board of directors. "That son of a bitch knows oil." They were only partly right, for if Rusk quickly mastered the intricacies of dealing in leases, he never could visualize the lake of oil which lay hidden under his ranch and under the leases he controlled. Kimbrough was powerless to explain that an oil field was one of the most delicately balanced marvels of nature. "Floyd, God damn it, our field has a limited life. The pressure which delivers the oil to us must be maintained." Kimbrough drew maps of the underground reservoir, showing Floyd how the entrapment by rocks kept the lake of oil in position, and how water and gas provided the pressure which enabled the drillers to bring it to the surface. "Destroy that pressure, or dissipate it, and you can lose your field." He astounded Rusk by predicting that if wells continued to be dug so promiscuously at Larkin, the pressure would be drawn off at so many random sites that only about 10% of the oil locked underground would ever be recovered. And when Rusk did finally understand this, it had exactly the opposite result from what Kimbrough had intended. "By God, if it's limited, let's get ours now." So he dug numerous wells on his own property, producing vastly more raw petroleum than could be marketed, and on his better leases he encouraged everyone else to do the same, until Larkin fairly groaned with oil. When all the fuel lines were jammed and the open earthen pits were rotting with the dark stuff, whose volatile oils were thus dissipated, he watched as the price dropped from $1 a barrel to the appalling figure of 10 cents, and even then he could not comprehend the need for more disciplined measures. Like a true Texan, he bellowed, "We don't want no government interference. We found this field, we developed it, and by God we'll work it our way. His wasteful procedure was not preposterous so far as he was concerned, because he had varied ways to multiply his wealth. He owned 33 wells outright, he shared a 75% interest in 19 others, and he received huge yearly rentals for leases which the big companies held on the acreage he could not himself develop. By the close of that first year, he was a millionaire four times over, with every prospect of doubling and then redoubling and then quadrupling. His tremendous good luck had little effect upon him personally, for he rarely spent money on himself beyond the sheerest necessities. He still moved his huge bulk about the oil fields in a Ford truck. He wore the same rancher's outfit, the same battered Stetson, the same cheapest line General Quimper boots. At the morning breakfasts in the café, which now had 30 tables filled with oil men, he never picked up the checks at his corner unless he had specifically invited someone to eat with him, which he did infrequently. He gave no money to the Baptist church, none to the school, none to the hospital. In fact, he attended only spasmodically to his income and would have been unable to tell anyone how much he had accumulated. He did buy three good bulls, for in Texas, oil and ranching enjoyed a symbiotic relationship, which no northern oil man ever understood. If you took 1,000 Texas oil wells, you could be sure that 900 were drilled so that some dreaming man without a dime could buy himself a ranch, for it was said in the business, "Ain't nothing makes a steer grow better than good pasturage, a pinch of phosphorus in the soil, and freedom to scratch yourself on an oil derrick." With his first big check from Gulf for his leases, he purchased an additional 5,000 acres for his ranch, and with his second check, he drove north to meet with Paul Yeager. "I think my father made a mistake promising you this land, and I made a bigger mistake transferring it to you legal. Paul, I want to buy it back. Name your price." "I'm not selling." "Paul, you got no mineral rights, you got no leasing rights. To you, this is just so much rock and grama grass. You'll never do anything with it. I need it. I told you, it's not for sale. You know we're going to put 6-7 more wells on your place." "I don't think you are." "Now, Paul, law's the law. Name your price. $60 an acre? $80? Rusk was unable to swing a deal, and some days after he had sent his men up to the tank to start a new well on the Yeager land, they came roaring back with a horrendous story. "Like you ordered, we was headed for the north end of the Yeager lease, but he met us at the gate with a shotgun. We said, 'We got legal right.' And he said, 'No more laws. You come on my land, I shoot.' So we drove right in, as you said to do, and by God, he shot. Kill anybody? Elmer's hurt bad. Doctor's tendin' him." In gargantuan fury, Floyd Rusk rampaged around town looking for the sheriff, and after he found him, a posse drove north to handle Paul Yeager. They found him standing at the gate to his ranch, shotgun still in hand. "Don't come in here," he warned. "Paul, the law says..." "Stand back, fat belly. No more of your trucks on my land." "Yeager," the sheriff shouted, "put down that gun and..." Yeager fired, not at the sheriff, but at Rusk, who with extraordinary nimbleness dropped to the ground, whipped out his Colts, and drilled his brother-in-law through the head. There were 17 witnesses, of course, to testify that Paul Yeager had aimed a shotgun at the sheriff and had nearly killed Floyd Rusk, who had fired back in self-defense. No trial was ever held. And after the burial, Rusk asked the sheriff to ride out to the Yeager ranch and offer Mrs. Yeager a good price for her lands, without saying who the bidder was. Before the month was out, Rusk had regained the land his father should never have given away, and the Rusk rigs were free to move about it as they wished. If Floyd Rusk was little moved by his sudden wealth, this was not the case with Molly, for when that first check from Gulf Oil proved that prosperity was real, she went to Ed Boatwright at the Chevy Garage, rented a car and a driver, and posted in to Neiman Marcus in Dallas. There she went to the most expensive salon in the store and announced in a loud voice that she wanted the head saleslady and a very large wastebasket. When she was shown into a discreet area where only the best clothing was sold, fabrics from England, styling from France, she started undressing, throwing each of her old and long-worn garments into the wastebasket. And when it was filled with every item except her panties, she announced, "I want them burned. We'll take them to the basement. I want them burned here. I never want to see those damned rags again. But, madam, don't madam me. Burn them." The manager was called, but since Molly was nearly naked, he could not speak with her directly. He did, however, give strict orders that there would be no burning of anything on that floor. But Molly was so vociferous that he asked, "Who is this crazy dame?" And Molly heard the saleswoman explain, "She's the wife of that fellow who hit the big oil field at Larkin." And the manager said, "Burn them." Firemen were alerted, but before they could appear, Molly was covered with an expensive lounging robe, of which she said, "I'll take it." And so draped, she watched as men with fire extinguishers supervised the burning of her old wardrobe. When the fire went out and her applause died down, she proceeded to spend $5,600 on replacements and left an order for $3,800 worth of other items to be sent to Larkin as soon as they arrived from New York and London. She sent Ed Boatwright's driver home alone, carrying in the back of his Chevy many of her purchases. For herself, she bought a large new Packard from a Dallas dealer recommended by Neiman Marcus and hired one of the firm's drivers to chauffeur her back to Larkin. In 4 months, the population of Larkin jumped from 2,329 to more than 19,700, and this resulted in revolutionary change. Take housing, for example. The little town obviously could not accommodate such a tremendous influx in existing structures. So extraordinary solutions had to be sought. And old-time residents gasped when they saw a convoy of 60 mules on the road from Jacksboro, each four hauling on a farm flatbed, a house lifted from its foundations farther east. Tents were at a premium, and any householder with a spare room could rent it at $3 a day to each of four occupants. Many beds were used three times a day in 8-hour shifts, and food was grabbed wherever it was provided and in whatever condition. Every businessman saw his turnover quadrupled within the month, and by the end of the year, men who sold what the oil crews needed found themselves enormously wealthy. The Tumlinson twins maintained 6 trucks to haul in the long lengths of lumber required for building derricks and the associated small buildings at a site. They also imported huge supplies of coal for the winter months, and almost any hardware they could find in places like Fort Worth and Dallas. One twin said, "All we are really is a turnover point. We rarely keep anything past the weekend." And Ed Boatwright sold absolutely any car he could get his hands on, and employed 6 new mechanics to keep the cars he had sold running. "The roads to an oil field are murder on cars, but my men are geniuses." The sudden inflow of money altered many things, because it was the very type of man who had played a major role in the reactionary Ku Klux Klan who found himself in position to make the most profit from the exploding trade. And one-time leaders like the Tumlinson twins and Boatwright became so preoccupied with their expanding business that they no longer had time to monitor community morals. An older man, who had taken the Klan quite seriously, tried to summon his cohorts back to the continuing task of policing. But some of the younger men told him, "Let's get this oil thing settled, the buildings we need and everything, and then we'll take care of the riffraff that's wandered in." The Klan did not intend closing shop. Its impulses were too deep and strong for that. But it did propose to make a dollar while the chance existed. Some activities of the boom did eventually occasion real soul-searching on the part of Larkin citizens, whether they were members of the Klan or not. The woman Nora, whom the Klan had once punished, now ran a house which contained 11 young women, who had flocked in from as far away as Denver, and no one could ignore what business the young ladies were conducting. The founder of the town's good fortune, Dewey Kimbrough, still lived in the house with his girl Esther, but he had to be indulged because he was now well on his way to becoming a millionaire, and that excused a lot. As a matter of fact, the former Puritans would have been happy if the seamier side of their town had been as quietly run as Nora's place. But Larkin received a black eye when a reporter for the New York Times came to town to verify the rumor that Larkin is the most sinful little town in America. He probed about for 9 or 10 days, picking up the usual colorful stories about a saloon called the Bucket of Blood and a gambling hall named the Missionary's Downfall. But such accounts could have applied to almost any oil boom town or any temporary railhead in the West. What made this man's story provocative was his detailed account of how the town fathers were profiting from the boom. Each Sunday morning, just after dawn, the sheriff and his enthusiastic men prowl the dives and the haunts, arresting any ladies of the night found therein, and carting them off to jail in the Ford paddy wagon belonging to the police. This happens in any frontier town, and is not remarkable. What is remarkable is that on Monday morning, these ladies, some of them extremely beautiful, are lined up on a public balcony of the fine red-and-white courthouse in the public square. And while the oil men and the young fellows of town gather enthusiastically below, a judge of some kind steps onto the balcony, lifts the left arm of one of the young women, and announces the amount of her fine. The men below then bid vigorously for the right to pay her fine, but the first bid must be the fine itself. Thus, if Mary Bell has been fined $3, the bidding must start there. But it can rise as high as the young woman's charms justify, and calls from all parts make the bidding quite exciting. When a winner has been determined, he pays the amount bid, and then receives all rights to the young lady for the next 24 hours. On Tuesday through Saturday, of course, she works at her regular stand, but on Sunday she will be arrested, and on Monday the auction will resume. When this reporter asked a Larkin official how such behavior could be justified, he explained, "We have to pay for the extra police somehow." When this story reached New York, the editors of the Times felt with some justice that here was a case where the legend of the paper ought to be respected, all the news that's fit to print. And they decided that such a yarn, with its many implications, would have to be excluded if the legend were to be honored. They killed the story, which so angered the young reporter that he gave it lock, stock, and barrel to a reporter from Chicago, whose paper not only refrained from censoring it, but telegraphed for pictures. A professional photographer took a series of graphic shots and provided a caption, explaining that the rowdy young ladies had on this Monday morning fetched an average price of $9.80, which figured to be $6.80 above their basic fines. Such affairs were amusing, but another aspect of the boom was more ominous. Any town which found itself the center of an oil strike, and especially one which expanded horizons with each new well that struck oil, was bound to attract the really criminal elements of society. And as the winter of 1924 started, Larkin had a plethora of gamblers, hold-up men, con artists, thieves, escaped murderers, and every other kind of human refuse imaginable. "This town is becoming ungovernable," Floyd Rusk cried one January morning, when two corpses were found in an alley near the courthouse. But when he spoke, he did not yet know who one of the dead men was. "My God, Floyd, it's Lou Tomlinson." It was. There was no record of his having been involved with any of the hoodlums, and he was not robbed. True, he was some distance from his coal and lumber business, but he was in a respectable part of town, and no one recalled his having been mixed up with any of the imported girls. His death was a mystery, but was soon forgotten. The shootings in Larkin produced an average of one murder every 2.5 weeks, by no means a record for an oil town. Usually, the deaths occurred as a result of gambling or fighting over women, There was almost no murder for profit, as in the old days when Rattlesnake Peavine prowled these parts. Opined the editor of The Defender, "It is understandable that men who have been too long restrained in less adventurous occupations will find release for their spirits in an oil town." But then Ed Boatwright was found shot dead, and people began to ask, "Is the lawlessness going to attack all of us? Have things gotten out of hand?" Some of the old Ku Kluxers felt that maybe they would have to reconstitute the vigilantes and bring the town back under control. Affairs drifted along in this way, with a gambler or a roughneck being shot now and then, until one day in early March, when the town echoed with gunfire, and the other Tomlinson twin was found dead. Now terror gripped the area, and men working in oil began employing armed guards. Chief among those frightened by the spate of killings was Floyd Rusk, who, because of his preeminence and his new fortune, would seem to be an attractive target. And when associates suggested that he hire himself a bodyguard, he listened. But one night, as he sat alone in his kitchen, he did not yet have an office, contemplating the dismal condition into which his oil town had fallen, a terrible thought attacked him. "My God, Boatwright, the Tomlinsons, they were with me when we whipped Dewey Kimbrough." He began to sweat. Desperately, he tried to recall anything that Dewey had said, either during the flogging or next day when they made their pact about the oil field. I'm sure he didn't speak during the flogging. Nothing. He deserved it, and he knew it. But then Floyd's assurance left him, for he could remember bits of conversation in the kitchen that next remarkable morning. "He knew I hadn't touched him. He said so. Yes, he did say that, I remember clearly." Taking hope from the fact that he had not actually whipped his future partner, he was beginning to breathe more easily, when an appalling recollection gagged him. "My God, I'm sure he mentioned the names of the other three. I can hear him now. But you ordered the Tomlinson twins and Ed Boatwright." "Jesus, he discovered all our names, and he's killed three of us." As soon as he thought this, he corrected himself, eagerly, nervously. "Not us. I had no part in that affair. I never touched him. He's killed the three who did." Then he rose and paddled about the kitchen, a huge, sweating man. "He's my partner. We bought leases together. Surely." He fell back onto his chair and stared bleakly at the wall. Three dead and one to go. Deceiving himself no longer, he reflected on the cleverness of this wiry little man with the sandy red hair. He waited till the town was filled with drifters. He waits till there's action in the streets. Remember the little pistol he had that morning when we talked? God, the man's a determined killer. Taking a pen from the fruit jar in which he and Molly had always kept one, he drafted a letter to the governor, whose campaign he had supported. "The town of Larkin, in Larkin County, is no longer governable. Please send militia. Floyd Rusk." He came into town on a horse, as his grandfather had done in 1883. Like him, he announced himself to no one, sharing a bed with the oilmen and quietly patronizing the saloons and the gambling halls. He visited the cribs in which the prostitutes lived their rowdy lives, and studied the bank which had already been held up once. He walked out to the cemetery and checked the rude tombstones for any names which tallied with his printed list of desperados to be apprehended on sight. And at the end of five careful days, during which he alerted no one as to his identity, he gained a clear impression of how the town of Larkin functioned. He was 25 years old, about 5'7", not much over 150 pounds, and he had the blue eyes so common among both the lawless and the lawmen on the frontier. He was quick with a gun, and more prone to use it than his grandfather had been. And like him, he was fearless. He did not consider it unusual to be dispatched alone to clean up a rioting boomtown, for that was his business. And on the sixth day, he began. presenting himself unostentatiously at the cafe where the oil men met with town leaders at 6 each morning. He banged a glass with a spoon to attract attention and announced, "I'm Oscar McNabb, Texas Ranger, sent by the governor to bring order to this town." Before anyone could respond, he moved like a cat, gun drawn, and arrested 3 men well known to be dealing in stolen oil gear. Rounding them up in a corner, he turned them over to the frightened sheriff with the warning, "When I get to your place, I want to see these men in jail." Deputizing 3 well-regarded citizens, which he had no legal right to do, he asked, "Are you armed?" And when one said no, an extraordinary admission in Larkin, he asked for the loan of a gun. And with his aides, he left the cafe and started through the town. Fortunately, most of the desperate characters, the worst troublemakers, were in bed at that hour, so he had little trouble finding them. And in nightshirts or trousers hastily climbed into, the gamblers, the thieves, and the pimps were moved to the courthouse, in whose basement he crowded some 3 dozen malefactors. This was not a jail, but it was reasonably secure, and he posted at the door 2 men with shotguns, giving them orders that chilled the captives. "If anybody tries to escape, don't hesitate. Fire into the mob." He then went to the sheriff's office and demanded that he summon the town's policemen. And when representatives of these 2 agencies stood before him and his new deputies, he asked scornfully, "Why have you let this town run so wild?" And they said truthfully, "Because everybody wanted it that way." Oscar McNabb, despite his youth and his bravado, was no fool, and after pumping some self-respect into the local officers, he went to the telegraph station and wired Ranger headquarters, asking for a famous lawman who had faced similar situations in the boom towns back east. "I need help. Send Lone Wolf." Then he quietly proceeded to consolidate his position before the rabble discovered that he was alone. He went to the home of Floyd Rusk and sat with him in the kitchen. No gun visible, no scowl on his face. "I understand it was you who wrote the governor. Tell me about it." Rusk was more than eager to. In fact, he blurted out such a lava flow of information and complaint that McNabb had frequently to direct it. "But you were among the men who flogged Dewey Kimbrough that night?" Later he asked, "Let me be sure I understand. Dewey Kimbrough is now your partner, and as a partner you like him just fine?" Finally he bore in. "Have you any possible clue, any proof at all, that Kimbrough shot your 3 companions?" "They were never companions of mine, Ranger McNabb. They just happened to be assigned that job by the clan." "You were, I'm told, the leader of the clan." He did not accuse Rusk of this. He merely asked the question, which Floyd rebutted vehemently. "I was never the Kleagel. We didn't have one, really." "But you made the decisions?" Again, it was a question, not an accusation. And again, Rusk denied that he had held any position of leadership. "I was just another member." "I believe you. Speaking as just another member, why did your group decide to horsewhip Dewey Kimbrough?" "Well, now, he was behaving immorally. He was living with this woman. You've met her, Esther, and we told him he had to quit that or get out of town." "You didn't tell him. You flogged him." "But we had warned him. We warned everybody. We would not tolerate immoral living." McNabb smiled as much as he ever smiled. "You seem to tolerate a good deal of it right now. All those women, those cribs." "Times have changed, Ranger McNabb." Just how much they had changed, McNabb was still to learn. Because he had not yet been in Larkin on a Monday morning to see the auction of the whores, and when the legal officials, who had not yet adjusted to his presence, proceeded with the Monday bidding, McNabb did not interrupt. He stood in the background, appalled by what he saw, and decided to take no further steps until help arrived. It came in the presence of a legendary member of the Texas Rangers, Lone Wolf Gonzalez, an extremely handsome man in his 30s, noted for his meticulous dress and deep South courtesy. His greater fame, however, derived from his ever-ready willingness to use the pearl-handled revolvers given him by citizens who had profited from the law and order he had brought to their ravaged towns, and from the fact that he would be the only ranger captain of partly Spanish descent. Like Oscar, he came into Larkin on a horse, and, like Otto, he did not announce himself to anyone but his fellow ranger. When he had studied the situation, checking the jail and the cellar of the courthouse, he told Oscar, "You've handled this right so far, but now we need something that will attract their attention." "What did you have in mind?" McNab asked. And he said, "I've had good luck in spots like this with a snortin' pole." "What's that?" "Find me two shovels." And when he had them, he and Oscar rode to the edge of town, where they dug a deep hole, lining it with rocks. Then the two rangers mounted their horses and dragged in a 12-foot telephone pole, which they placed in the hole, tamping it with more rocks. Then, in a series of lightning-swift moves, the two rangers stormed into one saloon after another and into all the gambling areas, grabbing unlovely characters at random, dragging them out to the edge of town, and handcuffing them to chains circling the pole. "Now snort," Gonzalez said, "while the decent people of this town laugh at you." While he stood guard, McNab hurried to the basement of the courthouse, where he brought forth his original 36 prisoners. Marching them, with his revolvers drawn, he drove them to the snortin' pole, where Gonzalez bound them to the chains. When the pole was surrounded by milling outlaws, he issued his orders. "Think things over till 4 this afternoon, then we'll reach decisions." As they sweated in the blazing sun, one of the men who had been drinking beer whimpered, "I have to go to the toilet." And Lone Wolf said, "No one's stopping you." And it was this humiliation which broke the spirit of these culprits. At 4, Gonzalez revealed his plan. "If you men are out of town by sunset, no further trouble. If you're in town after dark, beware. Ranger McNab, start releasing them." And as the handcuffs were unlocked and the ropes loosened, the prisoners started making plans to flee. When the field was fairly well cleared, Lone Wolf addressed the citizens, "People of Larkin, it's all over." Turning on his heel, pearl-handled revolvers riding on his hips, he went to his horse, signaled McNab, and rode back to town, where he wanted to meet with Floyd Rusk. When the two rangers sat in Floyd's kitchen with him, reviewing the case against Dewey Kimbrough, Gonzalez did the questioning. "In the period when the Tomlinson twins and Boatwright were murdered, how many other men were shot in this town?" "About 9. "What makes you think their case was something special?" "The others were drifters, no goods." This impressed Gonzalez, and he spent 2 days interrogating townspeople, especially Nora and Esther, whom he met together. "You say, Nora, that you and Jake were tarred and feathered, and later he was shot?" "Yes." "Do you know who did it?" "I can guess." "And you, Miss Esther, you saw your man Kimbrough horsewhipped. Did you know who did it?"
"I heard names."
"What names?"
"Lou Tomlinson."
"Who else?"
"His brother Les."
"Anybody else?"
"Ed Boatwright."
"And all three are dead?"
"They deserved to be."
"Did Kimbrough know those names?"
"He told me to remember them, after they let him go."
She hesitated, suspecting that she was doing her man no good by these admissions. "He was all cut up, you know, his back."
"Do you think he shot those three men, getting even?"
"I'm glad somebody did. They came back, you know, and threatened to whip me, too, if I stayed around."
"Why did you stay?"
"Dewey made a deal with Mr. Rusk. Me staying was part of the deal, Dewey said." "But if Dewey, as you call him, if he's Mr. Rusk's partner, he must have made a lot of money. Why does he still live in a house like this? Why do you live here?"
"We live simple."
It was clear to Gonzalez and McNab that Dewey Kimbrough had probably shot his three assailants,
but there could never be any proof. So one morning, when the town was pretty well subdued and permanently, Lone Wolf suggested to McNab, "I think we better deal with the principals." And they summoned Kimbrough to Rusk's kitchen. In ice-cold terms, they spelled out the situation, with McNab doing the talking, since, although Gonzalez was 8 years senior, he was the man officially in charge. "Rusk, you led the posse that night on your partner Kimbrough. Kimbrough, we know that you learned the names of the men who flogged you, and we have very solid reasons to suspect that you shot those men, one by one, in revenge. But we can't prove it. We know something else. If you, Kimbrough, have killed 3 men, so have you, Mr. Rusk. 2 in Dodge City, and Paul Yeager at his ranch gate. And Ranger Gonzalez and I have had to kill men in our day, in line of duty. So all of us in this room are equal in a manner of speaking. Ranger Gonzalez, will you tell them what we recommend?" "It's simple. The flogging happened a long time ago. If you forget it, we'll forget it. You've been partners for some time now. Good partners, we're told. Reliable. Now, Mr. Rusk, you told us that you were afraid you were going to be shot by Mr. Kimbrough, of course, although you didn't say so in your letter to the governor. I have a surprise for you, Mr. Rusk. Did you know that Mr. Kimbrough told us he was afraid you were going to shoot him to get his share of the partnership, the way you got Yeager's land? And we think he had good reason to be afraid." Rusk looked at his partner in dismay. "Dewey, my God, I'd never shoot you." "So here it is," Lone Wolf said, hands on the table. "You two are partners, for better or worse, like they say at the wedding. Make the best of it, because when we leave, if we hear that either of you has been shot, we're coming back to swear out a warrant for the survivor." "No court in the land," Rusk began, but Gonzalez cut him short. "Tell him, McNab. It won't go to court, because you will be shot, by him or me, resisting arrest." In this rough-and-ready way, the oil town of Larkin, after 18 months of flaming hell, was cleaned up. It was a Texas solution to a Texas problem, and it worked. The little town of Larkin, population reduced to a sane 3,673, now boasted 7 millionaires. The richest was Floyd Rusk, whose fortune from his main wells and leases was becoming immense. He was followed by his partner, Dewey Kimbrough, who shared in some of Rusk's wells and owned others outright. The Larkin field was proving out, as shrewd Kimbrough had predicted, a large, shallow field with an apparently unlimited supply of oil that seemed to dribble out of the ground, not gush. No single well was now producing much over 100 barrels a day, but 100 barrels times 365 days times 40 wells meant a lot of oil. Some of the new millionaires spent their money conspicuously, and Dewey often spoke of one who had never fully appreciated the intricacies of the oil game. "When I went to talk him into leasing up his land, I offered him the standard 1/8 royalty. But he said, 'I know you city slickers, I want 1/10. So, after considerable pressure, I surrendered. Sometime later he came to me, all infuriated. 'You dirty scoundrel, you cheated me.' I said, 'Hold on a minute. You set the royalty, not me.' And he said, 'I know that, but Gulf offered me 1/12. Rusk and Kimbrough built no big houses and bought no extra cars, but they did almost desperately long for some way to express their wealth. And it was in this uneasy mood that they discovered football. Not Texas A&M football or University of Texas football, but Larkin High School football. And in those years, once an oilman or a well-to-do rancher became alerted to the grandeur of Texas high school football, he was lost. For he developed a mania which lasted forever, growing each year more virulent. It started because such men worked hard all week. Dewey Kimbrough never ceased looking for oil. and longed for some vigorous relaxation on the weekends. There was hunting and fishing and breeding cattle and breaking horses, but in time these palled, and it was then that these men plunged into the Friday afternoon madness. In those days, Texas had no worthy professional football teams, or basketball either, and good baseball teams played far to the north in St. Louis. Even the universities were far to the east, but there was always the local high school football team, and in time its partisans became as madly concerned with its fortunes as men elsewhere became involved emotionally with the New York Yankees or the Detroit Tigers. Competing area teams like Wichita Falls, Jacksboro, Abilene, and Breckenridge became monsters who had to be subdued, fair means or foul, and the glorious days of autumn in Texas became heroic. The mania started casually, with Rusk and Kimbrough attending a Friday game in which Larkin's small high school was playing Jacksboro, which had a slightly larger student body. It was a good game, nothing special, with scattered scoring in the first half and Larkin holding on to a 19-14 lead as the game drew to a close. Jacksboro had the ball, and it looked as if they might score, for they had mounted a determined drive down the field. But as the seconds ticked away, both Rusk and Kimbrough started shouting, "Hold that line! Get them!" And the roar of the little hometown crowd must have taken effect, for the Larkin men, average age 16, did muster courage from somewhere, and they did hold. It was fourth down and 9, 20 seconds to go, with the crowd roaring encouragement, when the Jacksboro coach signaled his captain to call for time out. Always alert in such situations, Rusk noticed that the coach was wigwagging frantically from the lines, and he whispered to Kimbrough, "I don't like this. Something's up." It was a play which would be discussed for years in the oil fields, because just before the whistle blew to resume, Jacksboro made a last-second substitution. A tall end was taken out of the game, and a much shorter boy was inserted, a fact which caused Rusk to tell Kimbrough, "Now that's crazy. They have to pass. You'd think they'd keep the tall fellow in there." However, the tall end did not quite come off the field. With the attention of the Larkin team and most of the spectators focused on the kneeling linemen as they prepared for the last play, Rusk saw to his horror that the tall end had not left the field. He had run purposefully to the sidelines, but had stopped 1 foot from the chalk, remaining legally in bounds. At that moment, on the far side, another player calmly stepped off the field, leaving the required 11 players eligible for the final play. Rusk was one of the few who saw the evil thing the Jacksboro coach was doing, and he began punching his seatmate in the arm and screaming, "Pick him up!" And Dewey bellowed, "Hey, he's eligible!" But no one could hear the two oil men, and when the ball was snapped, the Jacksboro quarterback coolly dropped back and lofted the ball easily across the field to his tall end, who caught it and ran untouched into the end zone. Final score, Jacksboro 20, Larkin 19. Rusk and Kimbrough went berserk. Roaring out of the stands, they shouted that someone ought to shoot any sumbitch who would pull such a trick. They wanted the referee banned for life. And they shouted loudly that never again should a team from Jacksboro be allowed on that field.